Hello, welcome to Literally from the North Shore. We're glad you are tuned in. We continue today with Connie Ellis's reading of Shelter Half by Minnesota author Carol Bly, a novel about a handful of people in a northern Minnesota town. We pick up now where Connie left off last time.
Chapter 5. Pearl got old Bridget Garris safely through the shining revolving door. She got into the same door quarter as Bridget was in, just to be on the safe side. Some basic jerk, however, entered the next door quadrant and sure enough started pushing to make the door revolve faster. Pearl often thought she knew of all the ways that bullies wreck things for other people, but here it was again, a new wrinkle. A big guy trying to frighten an old lady and maybe make her lose her step, when all Bridget was doing was minding her own business, trying to get into that rich munitions building like anyone else. There wasn't much space to operate in, but Pearl craned around and gave him the finger so he could see it plainly through the glass, right up close to his face. He quit shoving. She was very glad he had quit, because this wasn't a casino where she was on her own time and could possibly educate him a little, once they all got out that door. Today, she was on duty for Bridget Garris. What's more, she was in VFW auxiliary uniform. Pearl kept right with her charge. Without trembling, the old lady went straight to the center of the room. It was a gigantic reception area, two opposite sides of which were fitted up with 8-foot-high glass cabinets. Inside them, life-sized figures carried machine guns and rifles. Placards stood on the toes of the statues of boots. This was a weapons manufacturer, so they were likely just models of infantry weapons. Fake forest was painted onto the walls behind the figures. Some of the soldiers wore American uniforms, some German. A few others wore uniforms that Pearl never kept straight, since she recognized only present or past allies of the United States, or present or past enemies whom the United States had defeated. Pearl was sergeant-at-arms of the VFW auxiliary of the St. Frizzy Post. She made up the values of the job description herself. That is, she saluted and carried colors the way the manual said to, but she felt that how a VFW auxiliary sergeant-at-arms was respected was up to her. She saw no need to memorize the military uniforms of the countless nations around the world. At this moment, she didn't like the way two seated receptionists in the huge oval-shaped space behind a wide counter did not rise and ask how they could help Bridget Garris. Two men outside the counter were dressed as security, but Pearl assessed each of them as straight wind tunnel ear to ear. One good-looking, one not, she figured no one trusted either one of them for much. One or both of the women, suited up as receptionists, were probably the real security. The front one waved a hand that was fragrant with freshly painted lacquer. She was probably using dumb receptionist as a cover. Pearl hated being made a fool of, even in the reception area of a huge weapons manufacturer, so she narrowed her eyes, not to see better. She had good vision for a 43-year-old. She wanted to show these people that the whole charade wasn't going to work with her. She took Bridget's elbow gently. Pearl said, "This is Miss Bridget Garris to see Brigadier General Gorater." Drying nail polish said, "Actually, General Gorater comes in to his office here only once a week." Pearl said, "That is 100% correct, and today is the day, and Mrs. Garrett has an appointment with him at 11. Nail polish turned around to the woman seated behind her. 11 o'clock is correct, the second one said. One of the men now came forward. "Will you take these ladies up, please?" Nail polish then spoke slowly and distinctly to Bridget. Not so dumb. She had apparently noticed both Bridget's hearing aid and her puzzled expression. "Will you please sign just at this place?" She reached for the clipboard and placed a fresh sheet on top of the others so you couldn't read who all had been there already today. The better-looking of the two uniformed young men now indicated their way to a double stand of elevators. Pearl could relax. All okay so far. The elevator had only the faintest sound. It was not made by Otis either. Probably some German company. Their guide pressed the button for them, but stood against the opposite side of the elevator. Yeah, Pearl thought, not exposing his back to us. Of all the tools she'd taken up with in her life, none of them had been this good-looking. On the other hand, she wasn't sure he could make 2 + 2 come out the same each time. It was too bad. Wastage of that sort was very natural in this world, however. Pearl did not sink into a bitter mood about it. Today she felt very interested in everything. It wasn't every day that a big shot like Stan Garris hired her to come in uniform and take his mother to Roseville to a huge munitions company and back with $50 extra thrown in for food. He gave them a wax new Tahoe for the trip, too. The elevator kept going up. Clearly, Stan Garris's mom was into major stuff. Pearl smiled at the old woman. "You look nice," Pearl said to her. "Christ, that's a nice dress." Bridget had clear skin and open eyes for someone, however old she was, and now color came up in her cheeks, too. "You look very pretty," Pearl told her. "This general better be worth it." "Shame, Pearl," Bridget said. "This is strictly business." Clicking, the door slid soundlessly open. Down a long beige carpet, without one single spot of spilled anything on it. Door. Knock. "Come in," shouted from inside. Their soldierly guide said, "General, sir, this is Miss Garris and her driver, Pearl." An old man rose up straight as an aging G.I. Joe. He wasn't in uniform, but he gave off soldiery. Pearl wasn't sergeant-at-arms at the VFW auxiliary for nothing. "Okay," she said to herself. Whatever Bridget was doing, every minute, it felt more awesome and good. A person could very easily spend their whole life among slobs. Nobody knew better than Pearl, without ever getting to do any business with a true, old, high-ranking soldier like this. Pearl commanded herself at ease, left hand grasping right thumb behind her back. When Bridget had shaken hands and spoken to the general, Pearl made sure the old lady backed up into her seat squarely. She told Bridget she would be very happy to tool around outside and pick her up in 25 minutes. Very happy to, no problem. Bridget Garris said, "No, Pearl, you might be interested in this, and I trust you not to mention any of it around town until next week when we bring it off." They were talking about Veterans Evening at St. Fursey. The old lady had somehow gotten the general to offer to speak. As they smiled and talked to each other, you could see they were each gratified by the other one. Pearl couldn't hear anything to suggest money. What surprised her most, somewhat, was how apparently Bridget Garris, who was on the internet a lot since she was the St. Fursey librarian, had met this big shot with this big shot office and this big shot armament corporation. Get this, Pearl told herself in a damn chat room. When Pearl thought about the people she met in a chat room, of course she herself never went to a chat room, except to get the word on which casinos had loose slots these days. Which exactly were the decent quarter slots, looking at it as you entered? Where the dud machine stood, left or right, as you came in from the main parking lot? None of those people seemed likely to be retired brigadier generals. These two seemed to have met in a chat room called 101st Airborne, Pearl noticed, however, that they both knew other places. Something called Bundes Archive, and something called Rink. Some guy named Montgomery. Some guy or place named Stoltz. There was a Stoltz in St. Fursey, but she guessed they weren't talking about him. They were speaking English, but with so many non-English words that Pearl couldn't follow. One thing she learned for sure, this Bridget Garris, whom she had tolerated the way you tolerated all the old folks in St. Fursey, was someone significant. This old lady apparently was arranging this general to come for Veterans Night. That kind of top-drawer doings you expected from the Tenebrae's or the town clergy, not from the Adolot guy's mom up there with the rest of them in Denham Apartments. Exactly what it went to show wasn't exactly clear to Pearl, but whatever it was, she snapped to when Bridget and the old retired army officer at last stood up. They were shaking hands across the table. Pearl believed she knew a class act when she saw one. She stood up very straight, just behind Bridget, turned back to get the door like an official driver. Pearl knew her weaknesses and strengths. She had been meaning to ask Bridget if they could make a bathroom stop at Hinckley, where Pearl would be real glad to treat lunch, and maybe just do a couple dollars worth of quarters at the casino. She sure wasn't going to ask that kind of a favor now, not now that Bridget had risen in her estimation. Pearl had used to kid sometimes at the VFW or during the breaks at ecumenical chorus rehearsals. She would kid about the old folks. Ward Hines and Bridget Garris and the others who lined up in the back and scarfed up the food, whatever they had. From now on, if Pearl ever heard that deputy policeman, what's-his-face, Darrell, making smart-ass remarks about the old residence in Denham Apartments, she would go for him. She didn't worry herself about how she would go for him. Something would come to mind. He was no one to be afraid of anyhow. The VFW post, planning meeting, old Walt Steinsider had told Pearl that the deputy had dropped in at his gravel office just the past week to tell him to take down the big flag he had hung from his excavator. Walt explained he had run him off. That was the only thing to do. "Let's face it," Pearl said to herself, "when you live in a town, probably most of the United States, where most people are too chicken to look out for one another, and you have the good luck to meet some old lady like Bridget Garris with a whole lot of backbone, and who is equals with a retired brigadier general, the least you can do is make sure nobody motor mouths on her." They headed back north. Pearl didn't venture any conversations. When they were picking up billboard notices of the Hinckley Casino, Bridget said, "Oh, yes, that's the place with the casino. You know, Pearl, would you want to stop there or anything? I bet you could show me how to work one of those gambling machines. You'd have to explain slowly. I heard from my son Stan that the buffet is good. It'd be my treat." Pearl's heart danced. The very thing she wanted. How lucky can you get? Besides, what if she showed that nice old lady how to work one of the quarters? Maybe not one of the blackjack tables, though. But say Pearl moseyed around and found Bridget a hot machine, and old Bridget won a bundle. Wouldn't that be a nice thing to do for her? How about she took that 50 that Stan had given her for food and she helped Bridget win a couple hundred? That would go down pretty well, she bet. She turned her eyes briefly from the road. Bridget's face looked like a pale flannel cloth. The mouth was still smiling, but all the rest just cried, "Exhaustion." Pearl gathered herself. She said, "No, you don't want to go in that dump. Even the buffet has slipped, too. It doesn't hold a candle to the new meal replacement options at Dunham's Bakery. It's only another hour and a half to St. Percy, Bridget. Let's make it home and get us some sandwiches, and then you're right there, home. You can eat in your own living room." The old lady smiled, her eyes closed, and she slept the rest of the way home. Chapter 6. Serious snow fell on Sunday afternoon when St. Percy's ecumenical choir were rehearsing. Another several inches fell in the night. The snow was great as always, but especially for people who lived in ratty neighborhoods like Imogen Tenebrae's. It gentled the yard butt and the derelict cars of the poor. "Chill, chill," the snow said. "Of course, this dump and most of our planet are a shambles, but it looks as good as ever, doesn't it?" The new snow said, "This is really just the 19th century, not the 21st, when the males of every household hitched horse to sleigh, and everybody glided over to grandmother's house. The males are not incompetent or sadistic. The males are very caretaking fathers. The world is not overpopulated. The streets of neither St. Fursey nor Duluth, Minnesota are salted. And America, a republic, protects its poor from the hobby wars of the rich. Imogene drove happily in the dark, past the lighted reindeer of her neighbors' yards. They were not the reindeer of last Christmas, or even of recent years, but from Christmas of 1998 or 1999 even. No one took them down. The reindeer were always lighted, except when the owners had defaulted on St. Fursey area power and light. On Mondays and Fridays, Imogene drove into Duluth to be executive director of Women for Peace. On Tuesdays, Wednesdays, and Thursdays, she was the local school worker at St. Fursey Elementary and Middle School. Over the weekend, she had seen one private client and gone to her dad's usual Friday night gathering of local Episcopalians. Episcopalians and other intellectuals he had rounded up during the convivial weekend. The party had the usual pleasant people, even Tip the bishop had turned up, and her dad's big buddy John Rubrick, whom nobody liked except her dad. Imogene had practiced social work long enough not to trust character judgments made from people's looks. She felt confident, however, about John Rubrick. Some handsome, aging preppy who went to her dad's school or something like it. An empty man. Nothing major wrong with him, she said to herself. Just not much there. Gorgeous clothes, though. Amber Swift tweed. Gorgeous manners, too. He leased Volvos to get where he needed to go. Although whatever his work was took him on airplanes midweek, he'd kept track of the trivial news of St. Fursey. He asked about the mother bear and her cubs who were prowling around the edges of St. Fursey. John Rubrick moved about slowly here and there, smiling at people. He helped Imogene's father serve drinks and load the buffet. He twice made swift but non-intrusive moves that kept Imogene's mother from falling on the floor. He made it around to everyone at a party without seeming to work the crowd. Imogene joined him at one point in a short mutual admiration conversation with a couple of the community singers. They were grateful for her leadership in the alto section. The altos were always weak since you had to read music, and few of them did. Imogene caught sight of Eliza, the Episcopal priest, and dutifully went over to greet her. Eventually, Peter and Natalie, who wobbled but not badly, swept people up to the table to fill their plates. A pleasant crowd. Imogene looked around for Tip, with the idea of sitting near him. He was talking to John Rubrick in the small anteroom, which had been a small library when she was growing up in that house. Peter and Natalie still winced when people called it a den. Imogene had sat down and listened with the others while Tip told them how in high school he had slugged someone in the face and that he never went to a nonviolence protest vigil now without recalling the painful but delicious crunch of it. The other boy's sudden cry. He'd do it again, he told the delighted group. Well, but with the caveat that that boy hadn't grown up into a prize fighter over the years. Well, all he did was become a bishop. That was Friday. Imogene had two clients on Saturday. On Sunday morning, Imogene had made herself read and print off much of the online news service she subscribed to. She decided to go to Eliza's early service, then let herself putter around her apartment and be domestic until choir practice. At dusk, she trampled out across the rough meadow behind her building. It was stuck over with the afternoon snow. The woods hung cavernous with snow roofing the oaks' clusters. Imogene returned in the dark full of fresh feeling, though she hadn't caught sight of the mother bear and her remaining cub. Now, Monday. She didn't have to plan the day because it was Volunteers Monday. She and Kay Betis, her program person, had already laid out the short housekeeping agenda to start everything. One item of their agenda they did in order to buoy up the young women in the group. They would update the group about the new protests for peace around the United States. The idea was to buoy up their spirits, whereas the fact was The older, professional women in the group hated any offbeat testimonials and radical posturing. This morning, she and Kate were to show the volunteers new pamphlets available from COPRED and the new lot from the National Peace Studies people. Kay would pass out sheets listing good websites. Kay would read aloud letters from sensible websites like MoveOn.org and Orion. The Duluth volunteers were three-fourths young, middle-aged, either in professions or married to people in business or professions. These people's husbands, on average, made two or three times as much as the wives. At Women for Peace open houses, they spoke courteously of their wives' jobs. Still, one felt the weight. Not bad weight, nor good weight, just weight of those men's actual incomes, their bonuses, their stock options. After housekeeping, the volunteers got to do projects they liked. They sat at the long scab tables, still left from when the basement had been a church basement. The women stapled together VFW pamphlets. They painted quite beautiful signs to be jounced up and down by the considerably younger college people and the considerably older retired peace vigil keepers on street corners. This morning, Emma Jean found no homeless people on the familiar shambles of the VFW staircase. Six or seven of them, now that the cold weather was coming on, tended to spend the night on the staircase, trying to look as if they were clients of the social work teams who leased the rest of the basement space. They usually smiled at Emma Jean, did their best to crowd to either side so she could pass. They drew their dogs' leashes in closer. This morning, though, she saw neither dog owners nor dogs. Emma Jean's program assistant, Kay, and Muffy Laser, their steadiest volunteer, hovered in the hall outside her office door. Behind them straggled four or five volunteers who stopped talking to one another the moment they saw Emma Jean. Trouble. Clearly trouble. Emma Jean thought, well, it likely always had been only a matter of time. Members had been warning her ever since they leased that old church basement that if she went on letting homeless people sit on the basement staircase during the days, sooner or later, of two things would happen. People would pee where they shouldn't to save going out in the cold, or someone would molest some Women for Peace staff member or a volunteer. Since the old staircase did not smell of pee this morning, that left attempted rape. In any case, here stood her program assistant, Kay, and her lead volunteer, Muffy, both with the grave, weak-minded smiles that some people gave when they are about to attack. Behind them, the other middle-aged women, heads up, here's Emma Jean, swept back like jetsam away from the volunteer's room. The furnace kicked in. Emma Jean, like any administrator in a shambles of a facility, noticed such things even in times of crisis. The furnace snuffled and rattled its two filters on its yards and yards of fat tin work that still held up from Emma Jean and Kay's last duct tape job on it. Muffy gave her a handy smile. Can we go somewhere and talk? Muffy's middle-aged face looked crafty above the peasant Fair Isle sweater design. We're right here, Emma Jean remarked, key in hand. Come in, come in. Kay Bettis took her usual chair just as if everything were okay. Muffy took the guest seat, first gave it a fast rub with her hand, since Emma Jean quite often had one or another of the staircase dogs drowsing in it. Emma Jean now waited, social worker style. Muffy and Kay gave off an aura of determination, irritability, and shame. Bad, Emma Jean thought. The empty staircase this morning? Maybe someone had at last tried to rape someone else, so Muffy and Kay had already run all the trash, as Muffy called them, out of the building. Emma Jean felt the women gearing up to do the talking. She felt Kay standing by like a tender near a major ship. Muffy said, "I want to voice some concerns everybody's been having." A pause. "Actually, Emma Jean, my husband has been concerned about this longer than I have." One by one, Muffy laid out her husband's concerns. Every so often, Muffy interrupted herself. She was holding a 3x5 index card with notes on it to say, But these aren't just my husband's concerns, Imogene. They're mine, too. In fact, the others, too. The whole group, really. In a word, they wanted to put a halt to all present vigils for peace in Duluth, all sponsoring of face climbing at Wisconsin military installations, all Picard marches on Superior Street, London Road, and especially Canal Park Drive. Muffy said, "We want to turn a fresh page. We have been putting together some ideas for innovative approaches to peace work." Imogene recalled some ancient page of an ancient MSW course text. "It is always good to look at new ideas. What have you got?" "We want to organize travel tours with a peace theme," said Muffy. Imogene sat up straighter. Their idea, Muffy told her, was to quit all protesting as such and get started with two travel tours going this coming winter, for which either Icelandic Air or Northwest Airlines promised, if the tour filled, free fare to both the Women for Peace leader and one assistant. Imogene said, "Women for Peace would become a travel agency based in Duluth, a kind of traveling theme park?" Muffy said, "Perhaps you are feeling hurt, Imogene, but that was such a cheap shot. I'm surprised it came from you." She paused, glanced at the 3x5 in her hand, and picked up briskly. "We'd have lectures planned as part of it, real lectures, like Elder Hostel, but not wasting so much of people's valuable time the way Elder Hostel does. For example, on the Irish tour, we would have someone telling us the history of the conflict between Ireland and England. That would fulfill the category of peace versus conflict. On the Rome trip, we would have a discussant sharing with us about how the Republican government of Rome gave way to empire. There were other points. The husbands had never liked their wives scrambling up the anti-personnel fence at Minneapolis-St. Paul International Airport, and especially had not liked, "Before your time, Imogene," Muffy said, "that respectable professional women were hosed off that fence by order by some colonel at 17 below zero. "Not Women for Peace," said Imogene, "nor having civilized women arrested outside the School of the Americas at Fort Benning." "Those protests were not sponsored by Women for Peace," Imogene said. Muffy cried out, "It's all the same rinky-dinky kind of behavior." She seemed to recover control of herself and continued. "The husbands also made it clear that if they were peace-themed tours to places that any sane person would want to have a look at, they might even go on some themselves. And they would contribute. They would contribute. All this makes some fundraising sense." "Fundraising for what cause would this be, then?" Muffy cried. "For peace, of course. What else? But indirectly." Reg said they would contribute to getting the tour business on its feet, and then the business would be the rainmaker for peace organizations, and then the business would be tax-deductible. Imogene said, "Sounds like a plan, and clearly you have given it a lot of thought, and I can make you a terrific first-rate recommendation for a new executive director." Imogene sent a very glistening smile across to Kay. "K's as good as they get," she said in a slangy drawl to show how relaxed she was and not thrown off base just because a 100% creepy, serious asshole like Muffy Laser and likely her equally asshole husband had corrupted a fragile peace organization. "As good as they get," she repeated. The other two women looked away. "Actually, we couldn't agree more," Muffy said. "Actually, Kay here has been good enough to agree to be our next director."
You've been listening to Episode 7 of Shelter Half by Minnesota author Carol Bly. This book will run for 20 episodes through July 23rd. If you miss a day, remember that all the week's episodes are posted on our website, ktwh.org, on the Literally from the North Shore page, on the program's drop-down menu at the top of the homepage. Be sure to tune in again for the next episode of Shelter Half.